Good afternoon. This is Patricia Reedy of Luna Dance Institute, and I welcome you to this Bay Area Dance Week podcast about dance teaching inquiry. At Luna, we use inquiry as a form of staff development. Teachers ask a critical question about their teaching practice and spend a semester or a school year methodically collecting information on their topic. Typically, teachers make 100 in-the-moment decisions and make another 100 observations in any given class period. The practice of inquiry, like action research, allows teachers to slow down and focus their observations and their reflections in action. For the past 3 years, Luna teachers have shared the results of their inquiry projects with a broader audience during Bay Area Dance Week. The topics, all personal to the individual teachers, range from the rigor of creativity, improving our ability to serve students in special education, and trying out small breakout classes for the most vulnerable students at a school. This year, I'm delighted to present two teaching artists who will share their inquiry projects with you. Ayano Nakagawa will speak to you about deepening her skills as a constructivist practitioner, and Cherie Hill will share her inquiry into organizational leadership. Each artist will take approximately 7 minutes to present their questions and their findings, followed by questions from our faculty audience. In addition to this podcast, a PDF of resources discussed here is available. I will now turn the microphone over to Ayano Nakagawa.
Great. Thank you so much for that intro, Patricia. Hi, everyone. My name is Ayano Nakagawa, and I am a teaching artist at Luna Dance Institute. I teach in multiple programs, including Schools and Community Alliances, Studio Lab, and MPACT, which stands for Moving Parents and Children Together. So my inquiry project this year was really around my teaching methodologies aligning with my teaching practice. At the end of last year, I realized that that wasn't necessarily happening. And so I formulated this question around what is my role as an educator and how can that role shift to best support my students' learning interests and freedom? So I started with my own personal reflection and looking at the different models of teaching and different philosophies that I have learned over the years and have tried to adopt within my own teaching. And I was really focusing on a more constructivist approach to my teaching, which I've come to understand constructivism as the process through which teachers build on the knowledge of the students' interests and cognition. And so really keeping account for who is in the room, what their interests are, and building from the students' own knowledge. In this reflection, I read this piece titled Why Teachers Adopt a Controlling, Motivating Style Towards Students and How They Can Become More Autonomy Supportive. And this is a piece by John Marshall Reeve. And in this piece, the author lays out seven different reasons why teachers adopt more controlling methods. And I realized that that's kind of where my the discrepancy within my theory and between my theory and practice was this idea of control. So reason number four, which I'll share in a minute, was really the one that stuck out to me. And so reason number four is quoted as, "Teachers sometimes equate control with structure. Controlling strategies are often inappropriately associated with a structured learning environment, whereas autonomy supportive strategies are often inappropriately associated with a chaotic or laissez-faire one." And so truly, as a dance teaching artist, I noticed that there was this sense to prove myself in all these settings that dance is a legitimate art form, that it really is creatively rigorous, that it supports students in all their learning. And so I wasn't getting that from anyone outside. It was just like my own internal narrative that I'm still working on breaking down. And along with that initial reflection, after each class I taught, I did a reflection based on the lessons that I taught. And I applied these actions to my teaching across the board, but I really focused on my four-year-old class in the Studio Lab program because that was the class that really was the catalyst for me to go on this inquiry. So last spring, I noticed that my four-year-olds were not necessarily super engaged in the class. They were easily distracted. They were initiating their own games and not wanting to participate in what I had been offering. And so instead of getting frustrated with them or getting down on them, I really took it as a moment to reflect on my role as a teacher and how I could best support their learning and what I could be doing to help engage them. So then as I started this past fall, I'm sorry. And when I say last spring, I mean spring of 2019. So then in fall, the first thing that I did when I started my classes was this very basic question of just asking what my students were interested in. And the four-year-olds had no shortage of interest. They were so excited to tell me everything that they were interested about, everything that they knew about. And we co-created a list. And on that list were pirates, dinosaurs, and unicorns. And so with that information, then it was through this process, really, it became clear that my role as the teaching artist was to then find gap between their quote unquote non-dance related interests and my understanding and knowledge of the elements of dance. So for example, for the pirates, I was looking at pathways and we created maps on the ground and tried different locomotors to each point on the space map. And at the very end, I brought out costumes where the students were able to like embody and really create their own pirate. And there was a whole range of pirates. There was like femme princess pirates. There was, pirates in like neon outfits. And there was one pirate who was, who did this one four-year-old, who did a really incredible dance throughout the whole map and the whole space map. He continually crawled and then he would rub his hands and his feet together, and then he would crawl again and rub his hands and his feet together. And I was so intrigued about what this dance was. And at the end, he explained that he was a Goliath spider pirate and that he had learned that Goliath spiders rub their hands and feet together. And after class, I talked to his mom and she said that he's been obsessed with them. And so it was really wonderful to know that even though it wasn't necessarily pirate related, there was space for him to bring that interest to the class. And he was still participating in what we were doing and finding it enriching and enlivening. Another example was dinosaurs. And so within dinosaurs, we really explored the elements of body and energy. And there was so much to do with dinosaurs. And so for body, we focused on our own body parts, but also the body parts of dinosaurs. And before we even started the classes, at the beginning of each class, when I would say, okay, today we're going to explore dinosaurs, I would ask them, what do you know about dinosaurs? And of course, they know so much about dinosaurs because it is an interest of theirs and they're so eager to share all their knowledge. And so they would tell me like, dinosaurs are big, they stomp, they have sharp teeth, they have tails, they have claws, they fly, they swim, they're reptiles, they lay eggs, all of these things. And so we compiled a list together, and then through that list, I was able to organize like really quickly off the top of my head. Okay, so for body, we have all these body parts that they've listed and we explored that. And then the next week we did different locomotors that dinosaurs do. And the next week we did different energies that they do. And then the last unit that we were able to do before this shelter in place was put on us was unicorns. And I was really excited about it. And it was something that they had been interested in. And I know that unicorns are really popular amongst many four-year-olds. But something about the lesson just didn't stick. And they weren't as interested in it. They were talking about other things that they wanted to do. And so I took that for me as a moment to know that even though if it's something that they said that they're interested in, there's possibility that the way that I've created it or just that day that they're actually not interested in it. And that's totally okay. And so, yeah, like I said, I really applied this to my teachings in schools, in residential treatment centers and libraries and in the studio. And really what I found was that this shift in practice really helps me understand and honor who was in the room at the time and to be really more responsive to their interests, their current knowledge, and where they were at. And instead of trying to offer the dance content and then find ways to fit their interests, it was really looking at their interests and finding ways that dance content fit that. So it was kind of a shift in my approach and where I was entering the conversation and the problem. So yeah, at the end, they were all really engaged. There was this sense of liveliness and embodiment that I hadn't seen in the sessions before. And it was really wonderful to be able to support them in where they were at in their learning. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ayano. I really, really loved the examples that of things that worked, where you were able to use the kids' ideas and then just really let them go for it and then just guide their own creativity deeper. And I also loved that, you know, even though unicorns was something that four-year-olds might have been interested in at the beginning of the semester, by the time you got there, they moved on, which is so typical in early childhood. I'm wondering if anyone from our faculty audience has a question for Ayano.
I've got a question.
Joshelle, it's up to you. I will mute myself. Go.
Thanks, Ayano and Patricia. I'm curious about what happened in the moment for you when you realized that unicorns and what you had planned was not what your students were into. Like what kind of happened in the decision-making process or even the emotion, your initial emotional response, and then how you were able to move on and get to class. And how did you respond to that? And how did you lead them through the class?
That's a great question. Yeah. So when I started presenting it, and they were like, well, actually, I want to do this dinosaur dance, or I want to do this spider dance. I was kind of like, why aren't you into unicorns? And I was a little bit confused at first, but then it was like, you know, when you're teaching and you just have to be like on and constantly adapting and going through different scenarios in your head. I had learned in the past that something that really helped them feel like ownership over whatever we were doing was this process of creating their own unicorn or their own dinosaur. And so I gave them like 2 minutes at the whiteboards with markers to draw out what their unicorn would look like. And then to also think about one special dance move that their unicorn had. Because initially I was going to explore different locomotors with them through unicorns. And looking back, maybe that just wasn't advanced enough for them, or maybe I wasn't presenting it in a way that was accessible to them. But having this idea of like, oh, a secret special dance move that my unicorn can do really, again, like ignited their sense of curiosity and joy within this. And so they each picked their move, and then they got to show it as a solo one by one. And there was only four children in the class, so that solo format worked. I wouldn't necessarily do that in every setting, but bringing it back to them and just offering them their own opportunity to share something special about their own imagination and creativity, I feel like helped ground it again.
Thank you, Ayano, and thank you for that question. I think there's one more question here from Nancy.
Hello, Ayano. Thank you very much. I'm curious about, as you are considering future teaching, how do you see your inquiry is going to impact lesson planning for you?
Yeah, so this is something that I'm definitely going to continue with throughout all my teaching in whatever setting and through whatever age group, because I really do care about being responsive to who is in the room. I see it becoming, instead of necessarily like laying out my entire unit plan before meeting the children, I think having an opportunity to have one class to kind of assess where people are at and also learn about their interests and who they are, I think is vital to then be able to draw it out. And of course, I'll keep the elements of dance in the back of my mind, or even at the forefront of my mind as I hear about their interests. I'm definitely going to be using that first class to really take stock and ground myself.
Thanks, Ayano. So we're now going to shift gears and move to Cherie Hill, who's going to share her inquiry project on organizational leadership.
Thank you, Patricia and Ayano. Hi, everyone. My name is Cherie Hill, dance teaching artist and director of community and culture at Luna Dance Institute. And this year, I decided to focus my inquiry more on my administrative role. And I wanted to know more about organizational culture, mainly due to the fact that I'm new at this role as Director of Community and Culture, and it's also a new role for the organization. And I also am just really interested in culture personally. I think culture is really powerful and is a really important way that we as human beings interact with each other and learn more about each other. And I'm really interested in how culture helps create spaces that are inclusive and are equitable and that help people feel like they can belong and bring their whole selves to the table. So I kind of set out thinking about what is culture within the organization, who creates the culture, how does it shift, some really big questions. And one of the resources I used was to read Brené Brown's book, Dare to Lead, Brave Work, Tough Conversations, and Whole Hearts. And early in my inquiry process, I read one of her statements, which says, if we want people to show up to bring their whole selves, including their unarmored whole hearts, so that we can innovate, solve problems, and serve people, we have to be vigilant about creating a culture in which people feel safe, seen, heard, and respected. And I really resonated with that quote. I felt like, yes, as I'm new to leadership and I'm new to this role, I really wanna figure out how can I help create that space for our faculty. And I feel like also I'm interested in how I can create that space in my own art practice. When I'm choreographing with my dancers, it's really important to me that we all feel like we can contribute, we can all bring our honest and authentic selves into the process. And I know for me that's most satisfying and most fulfilling when we all feel we're really included. So I was really interested in that, and I formulated my question more specifically to be, how do you create a work culture that feels safe and is inclusive? So in addition to reading Brené Brown's book as one of my resources, I also used a tool that was given to me by equity consultant Lauren Maino, which is around interrupting racism and looks at unproductive meeting behaviors. And this tool was used for observations. I felt like in order to really observe what culture is, I needed to kind of step back, really practice deep listening skills, observation skills, and see how people were interacting. And one of the places I did that was at our staff meetings, because that's one of the few times when all faculty that's present on site is together, and we have a lot of interactions in that way. So I also used that tool. And then I had wanted to do a survey of staff as well around how they feel regarding their engagement and being included and their safety within the organization, but I didn't get to that. So some of the things I learned is that I am at the beginning of this huge question and inquiry. I've just like started really unpacking it. For myself, I think it's going to take years, maybe a lifetime of learning and observing and reading to really answer, if there is an answer, my inquiry question that I have. I also learned that, you know, leaders make a big difference when it comes to creating organizational culture, that we have a huge influence on how staff feels, how they feel engaged, how they feel safe, ways that they respond, and that leaders really have an opportunity to model what it means to be part of an inclusive culture and also to influence staff to feel more engaged. I learned that there's a lot of internal work that needs to happen in order to be an example of inclusivity, and that, you know, I need to be able to hold myself accountable if I want to really create a space where people feel safe and they feel respected. So those are some of the big things that I learned. I want to just share some of the advice that was given in the two resources that I used, first from the unproductive meeting behaviors tools. Basically, Kathy O'Bear, in her Interrupting Racism webinar, lays out 39 different behaviors that causes barriers to being able to feel included, to staff being able to feel engaged, and just says that we want to be aware of these behaviors in ourselves and other people, and just try to, like, you know, combat them when we can. So some of those are making inappropriate comments or jokes, belittling the input or comments of others, minimizing or rationalizing away frustration comments of group members, interrupting or talking over others, engaging in side conversations, dominating the conversation, only interacting and making eye contact with people like you or people you like. So those are things we want to watch out for. And then Brené Brown also gives a lot of advice in how to create cultures where there's bravery, there's courage, and people feel engaged and respected. And some of the things she says is for leaders to fight for the inclusion of all people, opinions, and perspectives, develop a system that includes power with, power to, and power within, reward others, rid the workplace of shame and blame, omit cover-up culture that uses shame to keep people quiet, let go of control and fear, connect with others through empathy, practice curiosity and confidence, live into your values and practice them, choose courage over comfort. And she ends her book towards saying the level of collective courage in an organization is the absolute best predictor of that organization's ability to be successful in terms of its culture, to develop leaders, and to meet its mission. And so what's next for me is just continuing, you know, to read, to learn from people, to take this advice into account and to practice on myself, how I can be a better leader, how I can do the internal work I need, and, you know, to ask for help. And also to just start to look at internal structures, like what internal structures we have, what internal structures that can be improved so that, you know, staff can feel like they have the courage to speak, that we can encourage bravery, we can reward collective courage and acknowledge that, so that we know that that is something we're working towards as we work to build an inclusive culture. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Cherie. Thank you so much for that perspective. I think it's over the years, so many of our inquiry projects have really focused on teacher in the classroom with children. And most of our work, as you all know, is early childhood through middle school. And so it's really interesting to think about this as really kind of inquiring into what, you know, shared leadership can look like within an organization and what's the leader's responsibility. So we have one question here from Samia, and Samia, go.
Hi everyone, this is Samia. Thank you, Cherie. I'm also very much interested in how culture and human behavior intersect, especially in an organization like Luna. I will say that I personally feel safest compared to all other places I've worked. When I came to Luna, I felt like I could be accepted and I could speak up and share my mind. The one question I have is around bias, because we are all inherently biased. And when we come to a meeting, how do we recognize and become aware of our own biases that are holding us back? For example, I come from a culture, and maybe it's just the way I was raised, where if you ask a question, it might show that you weren't listening, you weren't paying attention, or you should know the answer. So sometimes that holds me back personally from asking a question. As a leader in the room, how would you recognize that that may be the case? And more importantly, with kids, how do we recognize what they come to the class with, what biases hold them back from speaking up and expressing themselves? Thank you.
Thanks, Samia, for sharing and for your honesty around your experience at Luna. And I don't have a direct answer to your question, so sorry, but I think that links to the idea of how do you create this inclusive culture where people feel safe, because my hope is that if you have an environment where people feel included and safe, then they wouldn't be scared about holding themselves back and for asking a question. And I think, it's difficult because we all come from different experiences and we're all bringing our experiences into the room. And so even if you have created this culture and space that's different, people are still gonna know what happened to them in the past. And I think that's part of the internal work too, of being able to internally do the work we need to let go of things that have harmed us, to heal and recover from experiences we've had that stop us from speaking up or asking a question. And then to be able to cultivate our courage and bravery so that when we step into a new environment that is inclusive, we're able to enter that space with a fresher perspective. And then hopefully that space being inclusive will hold that for us and not, re-damage us or re-traumatize us from past experiences.
Thank you, Cherie. We have one more question and we've got about a minute. So I'm gonna ask the questioner to ask it quickly and sorry to rush you. Okay, Nancy.
That's okay. Actually, my question was about internal work that Cherie, you discussed a little. You also mentioned it twice during your presentation, and I'm curious to know, what have you noticed about internal work so far, if there's anything to add besides what you just shared?
Yeah, I've noticed that, a big thing I noticed in my process was I needed to move my thinking to focusing on me as a leader and the actions that I've carried as a leader. I think because I'm a new leader, before I would think more about leaders I've seen and what they're doing and what actions are they doing and what can they change. And then in this process, I was like, nope, I need to bring it back to me, to myself, and hold myself accountable and evaluate what I'm doing and to recognize that I'm a leader. And so I think that for me was the biggest internal work, was to do that recognition and to apply what I was learning to me and not others.
I think that's a perfect ending, because at the end of the day, we are all, as educators, we both have power and we have lack of power. And I think knowing when to take yours and when to share yours is just really an ongoing lifelong process. So thank you to Cherie and Ayano for your bravery and sharing your expertise with us. And for those of you who are listening to our podcast, I just want to ask you for your patience with us, because this is our first time making a collective podcast, and there might be some gaps and there might be some external life noises as we're all adapting to recording during COVID-19 shelter in place, but we really appreciate your interest and we thank you for your time.